I'd actually like to ask the three of you to come and sit and turn chairs towards the rest of the room, and then we'll open it up for questions. Questions? Comments?
I'll just put my email in the, because I know it's not even relevant, so.
I've got a question for Jason. I'm wondering, in the discussion of sort of bodiless identity online, is certainly not a new one. He's not representing as such an application by any means. I wonder if you can speak to this weird thing that we do, though, where the more advanced technology gets to be online, the more we try to make the online world just a replication of reality. So we're not, in fact, becoming bodiless. We're taking bodies with us. We're just choosing different bodies. I wonder how that conversation, which has been going on for a few years, might sort of spin into or out of or through what you're talking about.
Well, like you said, stepping on a new subject, we're sort of, I guess we create these worlds that are similar to our own because that's all we know, right? So we're creating things like Second Life where you go get a game, you go whatever you want to do, because that's what we know, that's what we want to do. But for me specifically, I think for most people, they go online, they just go and do shopping or whatever, you know, go to eBay, hopefully not kill people. But other people who are like the wilds, it's a good thing for them to be able to go, well, that's part of my subject, because it's, they can go online and do things that they can't do normally. And I find that in the future, these kind of worlds will be created more and more realistically, where people like the wilds can go and be digitally themselves that they want to be, where they can't be in a real world.
Just one of the interesting things you mentioned is the idea that once you're online, your geography matters less and less. Mm-hmm. It's really not a matter of how close you are to anything, it's a matter of whether you can access it from anyone to the network. Which would seem to suggest that the really early forms of MUDs, the ones where you really were just typing things in, where in theory, if the system weren't designed otherwise, you could just say, go to the store, and bang, you're at the store. That seems to me to be a more accurate representation of what it's like to be on a network, rather than a system where you actually have to walk your avatar from one place to another, because that distance is moving up for anyway. And just sort of, I'm not sure if there's a question in there. It just seemed a weird irony that the more advanced our technology gets, the more, in a strange way, we seem to dumb down the world that it can create, because we're into replication as opposed to embracing some kind of a digital geography, for lack of a better term. I don't know, what do you think?
Well, the Metaverse project that I had there was one where it was actually closer to, like you said, MUDs, where you can go to a specific place and go shopping, whatever, without having to do the walking distance. Right now, we're sort of in the process of a big split, I guess, in technology, where some people are trying to just recreate the world as it is now, and other people are trying to do something new, trying to push the boundaries a little bit more. But it's really hard since we don't know what can be done. So people are trying to do things like Solipsis, which is an amazing project that's going on. I can't explain the paper in front of me, but people are trying to do that, but we don't know how we will go about doing it. So I think within 10, 20 years, there's going to be a lot more projects where the world will be, like digital world, will be shifting away from reality that we have right now.
Other questions, comments?
This could be the shortest session.
You're not representing yourself as an expert on managing bird flu.
No.
But is there any room in the flow of management there for not killing off millions of birds? I you know, sort of like caring about the birds themselves.
Well, the problem, I think, one of the problems starts, of course, with how bird farming, poultry farming works. You know, you cram lots of animals in very small space, they tend to pass on diseases very quickly. So maybe bird flu is a lot bigger problem for birds in a cage than for birds in the wild. So that's one thing. You say, well, you know, let this be. That's an H5N1 evolved itself. That's probably the only alternative. Because the other things that they do is, you know, keep your poultry in. But as soon as one chicken is infected, like you then basically create the conditions like in Western Virginia, where you had Ebola amongst monkeys, you basically condemn the others to death as well. So we're calling them more, letting them fester with their virus. I don't know which one of them is less cruel. So we should change poultry farming.
Oh, you stuck. I loved your performance. It was great. I was wondering to myself, think of the fantasy of the film Terminal, and I'm sure you've seen it, with Tom Hanks. And I'm just wondering, is it not possible to still save subjectivity and that singularity that I was playing with, that the force, the insistence of his own, you know, demeanor opened up doors.
Oh, yes, so. And it will not have anything to do with how the airport works. Right? That clearly, of course, this is the funny thing about life at airports, is that that's the way people are. I mean, you may be reduced to a biometric code, it doesn't mean you have to behave like that.
Right.
So, no, sure. Of course, you can imagine that that may become a problem for airports if, you know, too many kids are running around like wild monkeys and they get told to contain them. But the funny thing about sterile spaces in airports is they do extremely well with a kind of limited subjective freedom. So this is the space in which you can be a child. At Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, they've got a kids play zone, right? Where kids can be kids, and further down you have these sort of machines where people can just free. Jason's, you know, the ones who killed themselves. About that fly just but that's, you can see how contained that is.
Yeah.
And try to be an extreme subject like Eric or Alex.
Yeah.
I don't think you can get very far. I think that the whole system is geared exactly towards those modes of resistance. So what is it in airports that make us behave the way they do? Well, to some extent, it's the hassle you get if you don't. Right? And you may say, well, yeah, there is still subjectivity involved. Yeah, that's probably true, and you probably see that there's still learning. We're still an intelligent agent there, but we only seem to be intelligent for one particular end.
Thanks.
Jason, I'm wondering, you in the presentation talked about the way in which Second Life, the other labs and so forth, enable people with disabilities to imagine worlds where they might be able to do things they might not be able to in the embodied world. But I'm wondering if you've given any thought to Berilio's discussion some time ago about the way that cyber technologies, in effect, sort of make us all sort of people with disabilities, sort of disable us all. And then have you been thinking about the sort of reciprocal exchange that occurs, the benefits to one group, but then what it may be doing on the other side? I mean, you could tie that into the video game discussion about video games making kids fat.
Never. I guess I did touch on a little bit where the anonymity of it can actually be a negative effect, where we're not actually get into the people's disabilities when we're online. We actually sort of ignore it, and we're not able to work it out in the real world. These people who are going online like the Wilds, they discuss it with people. They don't tell people that they have cerebral palsy. They go around and behave as if they'd be, not with mental disorder. So they're not, in a way, working out their problems. I'm not saying these specific people, I'm just saying in general, some people wouldn't. And so the anonymity and the disembodiment would be a negative effect with that. There's also things like people have been researching on bios for kids and all that, but that's been beaten to death. So.
Yes. Can I ask a question? I've got a question to Erin. And I was sort of clocking out at the very end of the debate because my nerves started to choke me. But you were mentioning modal space, right? And Bill Connolly's work. I was wondering whether you were using Bill or not. Would you consider using modal space with kind of a Nietzschean reminder of kind of think of good and evil in a non-moral sense, or whether how do you feel restricted? Do you feel, for example, restricted by the idea that it still has to come up with sort of a political project where there are good and bad things, and is that why you feel that the law, we have to have the law? or it want to reinstate the law in lawlessness. Is it, I mean, I wonder how much your thoughts on that are.
Yeah, no, I'm just going back and forth on that myself, thinking through some of these ideas. I think the fact that morality as it's often thought of as judgment, which gets into ideas of good and evil and right and wrong, things like that, and that's very much linked to the law. I guess basically I'm trying to think of a way outside of that kind of idea of morality as judgment and whatever else, and not to reach well at all, but just I guess getting into more of an ethical idea of I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly.
Because my point is, law is always the same. Like, if the people who make laws don't like how the laws work out, they change the laws. And of course, in a state of emergency, they need the laws, mm-hmm. right? Or they have a law which says you don't need the law here. Mm-hmm. But would you, for example, as a human rights advocate, say, well, even in these spaces, we need some sort of semblance of law. How confident are you that that law will actually not serve further?
So the way that it is right now,
it's objective. Yeah, because law is, of course, not the same as morality. With or without judgment, or not. I'm actually pessimistic.
No, I don't know. I think, are you getting at the fact that there's kind of the idea of rule of law versus executive powers taking over, is that kind of distinction?
Yeah, but the rule of law, see, there is this program called Law and Order, which we finally got in Britain now. You can see the way in which they use the law, the sort of suspend their agency, right? Okay, my own personal feelings are the death penalty are that someone who's just 18 shouldn't be killed, but the law says that we should consider the death penalty, so I will consider the death penalty. Mm. Right, now that's kind of rule of law, in, I would say, in a morally simple sense, regardless of whether you want to talk about good or evil judgment. So my point was, when you ask those final three questions, mm-hmm. yeah, is there, could you ask a fourth question, if you like, you know, could we conceive of something else than reinstating the law? Or is that the only thing we poor people have? I mean, this is a genuine question.
Yeah, I think Agamben actually talks about that as well a little bit. He asked the question, is it possible to deactivate or get rid of the actual violence in law and just have laws, you know, something that's there but doesn't actually have to have this kind of violence all into yeah. violent being incarcerated or death penalty or something like that. But if there are laws that's possible, it's got this kind of devaluation of human
rights.
Yeah. And I think it also ties into the idea of the contingency of law as being something that's developed through people's ideas, committees that sit down and think this is the best solution, so yeah. it's not actually coming from any kind of.
I wondered about the rhetoric of state of exception and whether what we aren't seeing is a whole mosaic set of continuums, not just a single continuum. Something quite a bit of depth as well of various levels or degrees of state of exception, and so airports would be one. The suspension of the law and regulation by protocol, for example, that, you know, through a whole sort of series of degree steps, but also, as you said, moral spaces, informational spaces, and video game spaces. Where you can maintain your own state of exception on your desktop, you know, while you participate in politely and civic life. Do you want to reflect on that sort of the way in which it's becoming much more of a continuum, I think?
That's interesting. Yeah, certainly. I guess the reason the question is the state of exception is just this exact distinction between. The cutoff of law and the implementation of kind of executive form of power, and is there kind of a merger between the two, or is there something else coming in that gives you degrees of state of exception? So, I hadn't actually thought of it that way, although I guess I was trying to think it through that way, through the idea of state. So you're asking if there's like a personal state of exception then? Or?
And if there are a whole number of spaces of exception.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think that's where I'm starting to go with this, as well as kind of looking at the idea of moral spaces for my specialization and digital spaces and whatnot. So no, I think, yeah, I think you could definitely expand it into a whole number of areas. That'd be really interesting to look at. That's kind of our starting school a little bit. But those are talking in the show.
And then there must be also something beyond that, presumably there's some kind of dynamic between the different spaces, right?
Right.
To police the risk flow between them. It would be very interesting to know, I don't know, where risk sits in that, or are other vocabularies, subjectivity, for example, in the interstices between those various spaces.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I did, I just kind of pumped the figures to it. But yes, looking for the relationship between those are sexual work and anyone else? Yes.
Sure.
We have time.
We still have time.
Yeah.
Hey, that's really long.
I guess also for you, Aaron. I think it's not quite a question, and it could really help when I talk to you. Thinking about the state of exception, I'm not terribly familiar with Agamben's work, but I mean, I'm aware that the original reference comes from the Prevention's final essay on the non-constant history. And in it, you know, he talks about the state of exception being the rule. And he goes on to say something about class struggle, which I wonder if you could talk about how it applies to the context that you're talking about with respect to, you know, immigration law and sort of operation of a racist state. And that's the passage where he says that the fruits of class struggle aren't actually things that are that go to the victor sort of after the struggle is over, but in fact they're these things that take place. They make themselves evident in the actual struggle themselves. So the fruits of class struggle come forth in its cunning and humor, basically the way in which people engage with their politics and act as well as good. Do you have a sense of how that might relate to the sort of thing that you're talking about? You seem to be placing an emphasis on the legal parameters, but then is there another way that you can think about how groups like No One Is Illegal here in Canada, or No One Is Illegal, or sort of groups that are advocating, you know, the abolition of borders, or sort of that are engaging in politics that goes beyond, I guess, the legal parameters that you outlined, and how those two things might interact. If that's a very vague question, but you do have half an hour.
I think that's what I was starting to try to look at a little bit, was can you think about the state of exception outside of law? So when I was looking at immigration practices, detention centers, and whatever else, I was looking at is there such thing as a suspension of identity or a suspension of like a biological person versus a digital person and things like that. I think I stuck with legal parameters because that's more in the area and that's what I'm doing. As well, for the most part, but I think the idea of suspension is key in terms of something that can be applied outside of the law, and whether it's in reaction to politics or whatever else. I think the idea of suspension is key to that, but I think that might be key to something that can be applied also as well. So I'm not sure if that answers your question.
I'm not sure if it was a question.
This is for you. I've been thinking about airports, because airports for me are sites of tremendous anxiety. And I was thinking about, I was trying to wandering through my experience in the Toronto airport in particular, as I was going past the SARS measurement mechanism, so that you can actually test your temperature as you're going through to ensure that you are not going to be a carrier and not going to be part of this viral trajectory. And I was thinking about these as sites of anxiety, particularly with relation to this sort of the mobile subjectivity, the flowing subjectivity, movement through space, movement through time, where it's everything is compressed and condensed, and everyone is together. And that was simultaneously thinking about my experience at Gatwick this summer, where it was like being in a sardine can. There were so many people, so many flights happening all at the same time. And I wonder if you could address this idea of the of airports as sites for the management of anxiety about precisely these flows.
Yeah. Well, this is a good kind of example where the kind of argument of sterility in airport as a continuum of sterilization meets its, let's say, physical, biological boundaries, in a sense that there's a limit of how much you can process and, you know, and how much you can sterilize in such a short time. And it's an interesting thing, because what you're suggesting here, what you're promoting is that this anxiety being generated by the very system of sterilization are also there to put you at ease. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing, right? This is how I people probably also not only submit themselves to security checks, but perhaps also think that they're not making this a bad idea, because if they wouldn't do it, someone may actually fly this plane into something. Right? Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. I had a joke about the weapon of mass destruction that they hand out here. But your point is very good, because here I think that what they look for in airports, what the logistics, what the system of control is looking for, is put your ease through commands. If you would just leave your subject even behind them, you would have no worries at all. Leave it there, let it be sterilized out, Lysol will do the job, if you like, and just walk on. Obey commands, don't think, process. And okay, you're in a sardine can, but we look after you. Right? So don't worry, we're in control. Which of course not always happen, and you could instigate experimental moments in a pyro Garfinkel type of way, where you would create an event where you test how sterile this really is. I don't recommend it, but it's you can show that it's fragile, and it's a whole paper. It's about techno hubs, really, and about intersection between molecular and the digital and amplifications. And that is what it, that is what the problem is, it's fragile. This space, airport space, is not at all what it seems. It's not at all what Fuller and Hardy and all their brilliant borrowings of Deleuze and Agamben and Radio do. It's not that good. And Gatwick is a great example of that. It's not that good.
But I wonder about the idea of what Linda Singer called epidemic logic, and how epidemic logic enables further intrusions into things like rights, into bodies, etc. And whether or not the avian flu, like SARS, has become an opportunity, and precisely introduced in the states of exception. Hospitals are also, I think, states of exception, in the way that you're talking about them, where those places become the first places where those interventions become tolerated because necessary.
Yeah, and they go far, right? It's kind of level of penetration that, has total disregard for the sanctity or whatever you call the integrity of the human body. I mean, one of those fundamental constitutional rights that basically every country has suspended straight away. And what do you think? You're going. And here, let's inject this into your body for your own good. And we subject to that because we belong to life. Right? And we, at that moment, are faced with an impossible choice. Either cling on to life as they have defined it for you, as viable, this is viable life in an airport, or you cling on to life as you have idiosyncratically created with those kinds of constitutional rights of, you know, you don't have to interfere with my body, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And everybody chooses life of the first hand.
Mm-hmm. But it becomes easier to intervene in precisely those spaces where we are not indifferent.
Yeah, we are not indifferent, no, we rarely are. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's easy when you are indifferent, because then you're just like yourself being injected, probed, or whatever, because it doesn't matter. It's the resistance to that.
It's the alien abduction they're really getting.
I have maybe a corporate form thought here, but it suddenly struck me that at least the subjective experience of wandering through an airport, and for that matter, wandering through a mud or these massive caves, is very similar to wandering through a mall. And I jumped to mind because I'm living in Edmonton for the last 2 years, and West End Mall is this great, looming, very flat thing on our landscape. I wonder what the heck the mall might be in reference to with all these kinds of spaces you're talking about, insofar as the only difference, as far as I can tell, is that there isn't necessarily a set goal. I mean, when I go to the mall, I go buy something and I leave. But that's not what the space encourages. The space encourages its own existence that you, in fact, wander around in interminably. Like I say, it's only about a quarter form thought of that. I wonder if there's any connections or overlaps between that and what you're talking about, this weird space of the mall in the middle of the city.
Yeah, I mean, we're almost chance on that space of the mall, aren't you? Okay, I'll let someone
I'm sorry, it was a really big question.
No, no, it's a good question that I want to respond right now. But if you have any thoughts, please.
I'd probably put it, like you said, very similar to a mud where the space is created. Like in a mall, they create so many different ways to keep you in for as long as possible.
Yeah.
They'll like give you so many distractions, especially if you have a mall. Like, let's say the mall's crazy with like looking at the penguins or, you know, going to the haunted house or whatever else there is. You know, once I don't think I want to go again. But the same way where online, they try to keep you there as long as possible. The longer they keep you there, the more money they can make, the more they can get you to do what they want you to do. And so it definitely is very similar in that sense. And with identity in a mall, you are mostly anonymous because no one knows who you are there. You can be what you want to be. You can, you know, do what you think you should be or you would like to be. But I think it's protocol.
There seems to be an inverse subjective experience here that ends up being the same thing. And therefore, you desperately want to get to your damn plane, get the hell out of there, get to wherever you're going, because where there's only wants to stay in an airport for very long. Whereas in the mall or in one of these online games, the encouragement is to stay as long as possible. And yet, in the moment, I'm just as bored in a mall as I am when I'm stuck in an airport. And yet, one wants me to stay and wants me to leave. And I don't know what to make of that, or even if that's related to what you're saying.
If I could address that it has to be acknowledged that certain groups are wanted to stay in malls.
Ah.
I know they use music to get rid of teenagers, like expensive things, so people don't want you to stay as long as possible. They want you to stay so long as you want. West End is an exception because it's more like a theme park. It's like lots of hotels and different events. So I'd say that, you know, so commercials, but it's online.
Mm-hmm. That's also why there's malls and airports.
Right. Yeah.
That's a really interesting point. Those papers are really excellent. I think they're talented. But I kind of wonder about the presence of those spaces too. Like I think about airports and anxieties. Penny was helpfully referencing as. I mean, that's where racialization can break down, and certainly where race and all kinds of identities which become unstable in these liminal spaces are policed. And so, like, I think just, I don't know, if when like, the landscape has flattened and the laws and airports get equated, it's not the brain of it is. Theoretically, I find that kind of problematic because it also takes away like, the differential nature of surveillance and the way in which different bodies are surveilled differently.
There's this arbitrariness in there. It's not everywhere in the airport. As soon as you pass the certain point, then it doesn't really make a difference. Right? Because it's like the kids, right? It's kind of secure containment. You can shop, you can drink, you know, there's nobody cares. It's those about those hyper moments, right? The immigration queue.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, which queue line to stand in. I'm gonna look nervous. I always get picked on. I wonder why. That's trying to wear ties and shave and I think that gives it away. It's a demeanor, isn't it? I mean, I know it's racialized, it's strongly racialized, because I don't get picked on as much as, say, Mexicans going to the States. Right? They get picked on a lot more than I do. But there's other things as well that you have to do, probably this stuff. They may have to do with class and comportment. And how you behave. Are you out of place? Or do you look out of place? Do you look like you've got something to hide? I've got something to hide. It's comportment as well. And there are people, and they can defy also racialization through comportment. And so I know what you're saying, and I agree. It happens certainly on statistical scales, but it can't always translate it to the person. Right? The anxiety is not always therefore contained by the outside markers of surveillance.
No, the performance, I think, has a...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think that's what Penny's I mean, when I think about gender identity and being police, like, airports is a key kind of thing, because that's where you need to often stabilize or fix that identity. At least that's what I'm thinking. It's like, my hair is not as common.
Okay, yeah.
I was in trouble getting back into Greenwood. But I think, I wonder about this idea of, you know, of containment and of enclosed spaces. Because I was thinking about an experience I had during the SARS epidemic where I was on a bus going from Toronto to where I live now, and how we were stopped by the public health service and we were kept on the bus for about 5 hours because there was a chance that someone who had been in touch at one of these hospitals was on the bus. But I wonder just taking another tack on the question of anxiety, about this idea of enclosed spaces and about the idea of there being a right and proper distance between people. Of the idea of the handshake separating people at a certain distance, but that the distance, the way they're packed into these spaces actually promotes transmission.
Yeah.
And there's a tremendous anxiety about that. Buses, trains, subways, as places that are enclosed, and therefore in need of additional regulation.
Exactly. Is the worst. Sometimes the airports are reasonable, but in the same areas,
buses are the same.
Yeah, well, they pick up these, so this is amazing. Mm-hmm. So it's true, and I think that generates anxiety. And this is the kind of miscommunication that you're talking about, mm-hmm. that becomes very pervasive. Mm-hmm. That thinking of this, the perpetual risk of contamination, mm-hmm. right? You just have this endless list, ever growing, never diminishing list of potential contamination increase with our mobility, device, very so mobile. And so, come back to those who don't travel. My friend Simon doesn't travel on the NHS because he's not in university, but that he doesn't have the SARS aviation flu things. He has a completely different problem. And it's good that we talk to him about these things because he puts me back on earth. What are you worrying about? I don't have a job. Nobody values me. And that's, so it puts things in perspective. So Fuller and Hart is a great book. But if we put it in perspective, once you leave the airport and you know, look at who lives on the highways towards the airport, and, you know, who serves it at the airport.
Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to make up a comment about editing and humor. It's one of the things that's not allowed in those hyper-anxious moments is humor. You can't explicitly outlaw it. You must not make a joke about the functioning or the non-functioning of the system. You must not betray perspective. And I think there's some purpose in moving to that level of analysis down to, in effect, the everyday in summer, and the kind of way in which it's never simply a question of law again. It's this moral space that is at the same time, not even just a rhetorical space, but a space of comportment and gesture and humor and funny looks, demeanor and mystery. Interesting level, I think.
Irony doubles, right? So, ironic state, talk, you know, the joke, doubles the entire register, right? It makes it completely insecure again. You're this far into the line, right? You should now no longer joke because you're risking sterilization operation. Mm-hmm. You get punished for it. You get punished for it in many different ways. Dan has a great story too about being punished for it. It's haunting.
Don't ever tell the guys that you could kill them with a pen. So they should take your pen away.
Easy.
How long were you detained for that one? It was more, how many boots did I have on my back, face down on the floor?
Wow.
Oh.
Well, let's face it, doesn't tolerate, innuendo or polysemia. It's a very, very literal space.
Yeah.
Very literal.
No duplication.
Mm-hmm. Good question. This is thinking about this program, the airline, that represents the airport as a place of kind of disorder and chaos.
Okay, yeah.
It's about kind of identifying mm-hmm. people who could be a problem, who are a problem, and sort of the ways that the airline works to kind of contain those people and work with those problems. Mm-hmm. I just wondered
It's kind of the anti-TV, isn't it?
Yeah.
We've got one that runs on EasyJet from Luton. It's a cheap airline, so that's a very class people go away. And they don't adhere to the protocols of air travel, so they create problems constantly. It's interesting. It depends on what spaces are that they cause problems. So if they cause problems at a ticketing desk, they're of a different nature than when they cause problems at the security desk, because they're further down the sterility path. If they cause problems in the airplane, it's probably the worst place to cause problems, because there are lots of local laws operating the airplane that can safely put you in jail for a long time for doing innocuous things. So I know that's great, isn't it? What they do is they show what happens to you if you step over the boundary.
Absolutely.
So they show you exactly why you're there, which is now what you can make of.
Much of this is similar show on the tube that we see here in Canada, which is a very, very strange thing with dealing in the management of problems and problem people, problem spaces, and the problem of time in the tube.
Yeah, they're very non-sterile, though, British tubes.
Any other questions? Well, Beth, thank you very much.